Well, as Kat reminded everybody, this, the title of today's sermon, is the first line of our benediction. I'll be going through those 10 lines, one sermon at a time over the next several, the next couple of months. And it really made me already hear this line in a new way. Go out into the world in peace. I've always heard that as a blessing, a benediction, and it is. Wishing each of us peace as we go forth. To go out feeling calm, ready, anger abated, worry set aside. But then I realized, as I thought about how does this benediction speak to us in this moment, into what we must be and do for the sake of our country and the world, I realized how much it is also an exhortation. Go out into the world in such a way as to bring peace to whomever you meet, the peace you found here, into your interactions outside. And right away, peace gets really tough there. Peace, real peace, goes deep. It isn't about a pleasant surface. Jim Wallace says it's a lifelong vocation, which doesn't mean, I think, that it's a job. You don't have to have the job of peacemaker. But if we want to rise to that occasion of being called to be the peacemakers, it's quite muscular. It means doing something. Not just letting things flow. Because what flows by is often quite violent. And then what do? We can't just have a pleasant surface where we smile and get along while things seethe underneath. That's not peace. As Martin Luther King said, real peace is not the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice. And so calling for peace prematurely is like what the people did whoever Jeremiah is railing about, whom he scorned so much. They cry, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Like telling somebody who's been badly hurt, oh, calm down. Don't be angry. Or just asking everybody to play nice. Instead of truly treating the people's wounds so they would heal, they dress them. A bandage should be a healing thing, not just a cover that hides what's going on underneath. So how do we really heal? How do we help ourselves and others, our community, our nation, really heal? How do we make peace, peacemakers? Fortunately for us, a lot of people have been studying this, and to be precise, to take a turn here, they've been studying how minds change. Because that's what we're going to need, yes. We've been saying for a long time this country is divided, and it should always be diverse, arguing internally, not all in agreement. I can't imagine a vibrant democracy in which there's peace, peace, everybody always agrees. But when we talk about how divided the nation is, it's not that just that we're split almost exactly down the middle, half and half, with very different visions of where the country should go, but that the division is so bitter. It feels as if on every hand, people have no intention of changing their minds. But that's what it will take. What is tricky, and this seems to be one of the first lessons of the book I've been reading and rereading, and use the Raskin Fund, the Barbara Raskin Fund, to buy a copy for our library. So it will appear in the Hamaker Library soon. Book by David McRaney called How Minds Change. So the tricky bit, one of the first things that he establishes is that no one really changes anyone's mind. Other people don't change your mind. You don't change other people's minds. We change our own minds. And that brings us to what works, what helps us to do that? Because, you know, we do change our minds. I hope, all of us, over our lifetimes. One secret, I won't try to recreate the whole book here, but one secret picks up on what I said last week, which is that people are actually uncertain in their own minds. We have a deep ambivalence, often, even about the things that we proclaim most clearly and loudly. And there are reasons for that particular dynamic. They're the same reasons that blaming and arguing and trying to persuade, much less ridiculing, aren't effective. They do not help people change their minds. I mean, do you feel inclined to change your mind when somebody has just told you you're an idiot, or that you don't love this country, or that you're a sucker? I mean, that's not gonna put you in the right place. Not only that, it is well established that people become more certain, more entrenched in our opinions when people come at us with that kind of attitude. And so they may be trying to persuade us, but we're just getting more and more persuaded of the opinions we already hold. And I mean us, not them. This is just a fact of human life. There may be some saints out there somewhere who are so wise that they are never driven deeper into their opinions by other people's opposition, but you know, they already believe everything perfectly, so we don't need to worry about that. No, it's important to begin with the understanding that even the people who are most devoted to a particular opinion are often ambivalent, or a better way to put it might be they have the seeds in them. We have the seeds in us for very different conclusions. Now, I said that we only ever change our own minds. We don't change other people's minds. But it is also the case that we don't change our minds on our own very well by ourselves. We don't do it in isolation. We do it in community. We seem to need, and McRaney talks about various evolutionary theories why this may be, that the exchange of ideas and the human ability to come up with good solutions to our problems, that's a communal thing. That's crowdsourcing going way back. And for that, you need a community of people saying, what about this? What about that? Should we try this? Should we try that? And need to listen to each other and reach a decision. That's not a group of people all trying to persuade each other. Very different. You need a particular kind of community in which people's ideas will rub up against each other, knock the edges off a little, shape each other. The kind of community it has to be, I'll come back to that. But I want to also note that, to a large extent, what is not effective is facts. I know. To a point. There's been research on exactly how much information contradicting our opinions we need to get before we start to actually think our opinions might need changing. It does work to some extent, but generally speaking, finding out a contrary fact has pretty much the same effect as being ridiculed or feeling like somebody's trying to persuade us into an opinion we don't hold. We just get more entrenched. Again, all of us, okay? I know I do it. So this happens. see if this has ever happened to you. Person A expresses a view that, to take a common political situation, a certain tax policy will be good for the economy. Okay, we should do this with our taxes, says person A. Person B, who disagrees, cites research indicating that such policies actually have the opposite effect. Person A, being a human being who is not easily swayed by a single fact, is unswayed. Person B concludes that person A doesn't care about facts. This ever happened to you? Multiply this out by a few million and you have a cycle of despair, a spiral of people don't care about facts anymore, at least those people. I, of course, care about facts. That we are in a post-truth society. Truth is dead. No one cares about facts. No one respects experts. Not true, by the way. McRaney has some reassuring things to say about that. Somewhere, I can't remember if it was in his book or one of the other things I was absorbing, trying to find some hope and wisdom in these last couple of weeks, someone said, you know, we're not so much in a post-truth time as we are in a post-trust time. I'm seeing a lot of nods. So that's resonating with you the way it did with me. We don't trust each other. We often don't trust the people who are supposed to be experts. Although, again, some people can be convinced on that point, can convince themselves on that point. We don't trust the government. We don't trust a lot of the institutions that are supposed to keep us safe and happy. And, you know, we've got some good reasons for that. And we don't trust each other. And so most of us, much of the time, are resistant to things that lead us to contradict what we already believe, because that came out of a community. That came out of the people we do trust. And when you say, oh, I think you should believe something different, you're telling somebody, I think you should leave that community where your safety is, where your knowledge is, where your worldview came from. Leave it behind. And go to a place that you don't know if you can trust me, you don't know if you can trust these other people, you're already with the people you trust. You can see why it's hard to change somebody's mind. But there's a lot of hope here. There's in Los Angeles an organization called the Leadership Lab that has a particular political agenda. It came out of an LGBT center. It tries to change people's minds about particular social issues. And after much work, often not very effective, they hit on something called deep canvassing. Deep canvassing, which they do, going canvassing door to door, speaking to people about controversial issues, is so effective that social scientists have flocked to Los Angeles to study. What are they doing? Is this too good to be true? That somebody could change their mind, could change 180 degrees in the course of a short conversation with a stranger? After one big hiccup that turned on a researcher falsifying data, the results of proper peer-reviewed research are clear. Yes, it really works. It really works. So what do? Well, it begins with rapport. Listening. Sharing just enough of one's own story to be open and vulnerable. To say, you don't know me, but we're equals here. I'm just a person. You're just a person. We're talking. Asking open-ended questions, and then listening some more. No arguing. No countering with, but what about this fact and this fact and this fact? Rapport means creating a relationship. one of equals, one of respect. Now, you may be thinking, I am a very vulnerable person. I have been traumatized. I am in danger. As someone who, say, is an illegal immigrant, I am not going to walk up to the homes of people who have been identified as likely hostile to illegal immigrants and try to talk them out of their opinion that we should all be deported. Just to give one example. You know what? You don't have to do it. If it's not safe, if it's just too terrifying, don't do it. This is not saying everybody must be a peacemaker with everybody right now. Nor am I saying that we're going to knock on Stephen Miller's door, architect of mass deportations, and try to listen him into a better opinion. But when it comes to more ordinary folks, blaming the lettuce will not do it. We've got to say, what does the lettuce need? Well, what do people need? They need to be heard, they need to be respected, and they need to be able to change their own minds. There's thought processes that can get us there, and that's a whole big, interesting part of study that I won't get into here, but someday. But basically, it begins, and to a large extent ends, with rapport. You have these conversations, you say thank you, and you go. The Leadership Lab is actually quite directive. They are trying to change people, and they will actually direct the conversation a bit. If somebody says, oh, no, I'm going to vote against same-sex marriage. That was one of their big early projects, was talking to people about Prop 8. If they say that, they might say, do you know anyone who's gay? You know, and engage them in a conversation about that. But even then, they don't use that to try to persuade. They don't say, well, what do you think it's going to do for her? Have you thought about how it's going to hurt her? No. They just invite them to think about the seeds that are in them. I have these seeds that say, bad idea. Do not let these people marry. I don't want to. Various ideas that are bad about that. And I have this idea, oh, so-and-so, I like her. I respect her. I want her to be happy. She's gay. Those seeds are both there. And what is so amazing about this process is people will talk themselves right into that seed growing. Because the listening, the rapport, is the soil, the right amount of water, the right amount of sun that seed needs. Now, this is very similar, and this book talks about various other forms, very similar to what therapists might call motivational interviewing. I think it's what Thich Nhat Hanh calls deep listening. And I'm thinking about it a lot this week as we watch a little drama unfold, or maybe a big drama. You know, a whole lot of people left what was then called Twitter when Elon Musk first bought it. But there was nothing like what we've got right now. Just millions of people signing up for Blue Sky. There's some other options too. Blue Sky seems to be the main recipient of this exodus from X. Over the course of a week, that might be critical mass for creating a new social media platform. Now, I have no illusions that a new social media platform is going to change the world. But it does feel like there's a real moment here, a shift, an opportunity. And there's a counter argument that's being made. People are saying, well, you're just leaving this place where there's conflict because people don't all agree, and you're going to a bubble. Blue Sky is a bubble. Maybe some people are looking for a bubble. It certainly can be if one doesn't engage with people who disagree with one in any way. But because of some safeguards about how people can control their own pages, and maybe just because it's new, naive me, it also has the potential to be a place for real engagement. A place where we can entertain new ideas that might change our own minds. Because real engagement is maybe not focused on the end, on trying to get people to change their conclusions. It's more about creating that soil, that garden spot that's just right for little lettuces like ourselves. Maybe it can help model the kind of community where we can change. So I want to tell you one story that McRaney digs into that gives an example of why there's hope in that. He was very interested in the story of a couple of people who left the Westboro Baptist Church. Now, you may know that the Westboro Baptist Church was less a church than a family compound. Somebody who left this particular version of baptism, which was founded in just hatred, homophobia, then extending to hatred for this country, boycotting the, you know, going and demonstrating at the funerals of people who had died of homophobic assaults, people who had died defending this country in war. Just this stream of hatred. People who could ever even entertain the thought of leaving that, they weren't just leaving a church. They were leaving their family. And leaving meant nobody would talk to you anymore. So you are leaving. Door slams behind you. No contact. You know, not calling your mom on Mother's Day and hearing how she's doing. You are out. That's a hard ask. And it's people having to leave often a community that they grew up in, right? That is their community of trust. As crazy as it might look from the outside, as hateful as it might look from the outside, it had a whole structure of trust and mutual support and love and care, because it's an extended family. And yet people have left. How did they leave? How did they do it? McRaney thought it would be that they just became so upset, so appalled with the doctrines of the church that they just finally had to split, as painful as it was. And in reading what they wrote and then meeting with them, he discovered that actually mostly wasn't it. Megan Roper Phelps, for example, who wrote about her departure and whose story became quite famous. Now she's quite affirming of LGBT folks. But she didn't leave Westboro Baptist Church because she started to have pro-LGBT opinions. That wasn't it at all. What enabled her to leave was that she developed a community outside, including because of people who were horrified by, targeted by, bless them, the opinions of the Westboro Baptist Church, and were still willing to engage with her. And so more and more she had this other community of trust and respect despite deep, deep disagreements. And when that became strong enough, she could contemplate leaving. In fact, she could no longer stay. And then once out, her opinions changed in lots of ways. Once she wasn't hearing these streams of hatred and this very narrow interpretation of religion, then she developed all these other opinions that would have appalled Fred Phelps and all who had taught her. But she needed a place to go. So again, you might not be able to speak to a member of Westboro Baptist Church and keep your own sanity or your own calm or your own well-being. Please, do not think I'm saying go out and do that. What I want us all to take from this instead is that we can make peace in many, many ways. We can help to be that community where people have real conversations, where people can begin to look at their own views and change their own minds because they're not met with blame, ridicule, I told you so, are you stupid? Because they can expect respect. If we can't be in that community, we can make peace by how we speak of others. That maybe when we hear people use that all or nothing language or catch ourselves using it ourselves, they, us, they, them on that side, we, us on the other. If we hear somebody say, including ourselves, say, those people just don't care about the truth. Or those people care more about this trivial thing than that really important thing. Their values are bad. They're just bad people. Well, when we hear that, we can help make peace by speaking for peace at those moments, by saying, you know, really, studies have shown that most of us have some ambivalence and that we can change and we are willing to change, as resistant as we all are to facts. If we can't be in that community, if we can't bring ourselves even to say a word when we hear someone in our community say, those people, we can still begin to be peace through practices such as Kat shared in the story. Meditation, connecting to nature, learning to listen a little better than we do. We can begin to be peace so we can perhaps be better peacemakers as we go out into the world. That's how we help change things for the better. That's how we can take this violent, hurtful, and hurting society and help make peace. Stay tuned for 9 more ways as the weeks unfold. But for now, let's try to be peace.